the gun culture in America is so much different than the rest of the world. And, you know, I think every country has a certain amount of gun ownership. We have more gun ownership and more gun violence, and there have got to be reasons for that. And I'm so glad to have the two of you in here to talk about that. So thank you for coming in and being on Badger Talks podcast.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Same, yeah.
So let's start out with, and I'll let either one of you jump in on this, what is it about America where we have these increased numbers, more guns than people? It's an incredible thing. Let's just start with that. What do you know about that? What has your research shown you?
Well, the U.S. population is 340 million, and we have 400 million guns. So as you said, we have more guns than people. A lot of it has to do with our history, and actually Nick has done some great research that shows some of the factors that contributed to it. For example, the pre-Civil War period. Do you want to talk about that, Nick?
Yeah.
Sure. So I think, you know, one place to start is that there's not one gun culture in America. There's a lot of gun cultures in America.
Okay.
You know, when you have 70, 80 million people doing anything, there's not going to be just one way of doing it. And so I think it's useful as a sort of framing device to think about not just gun culture as a monolith, but gun culture is made up of as many different sorts of ways as you could be an American. Mm-hmm. That said, I think American gun culture as a whole, if we're going to essentialize, is a little bit distinct, right? It's a little bit unusual. You know, one of the things that Americans will tend to say way, way, way more than anybody else is that guns keep them safe. And if you go to other parts of the world, you know, places with, you know, gun cultures of their own, that's a really unusual thing. Most of the time people will say, well, guns are dangerous. You know, guns are fun, you know, but guns don't protect me. That's not what the point of it is. And Americans are, I think, fairly distinctive in pointing to this idea that a gun is something that will actually somehow protect you from danger. And the work that I do tries to unpack this, tries to say, well, when people say guns keep you safe, what do you mean? And what are you being kept safe from? One of the things that, you know, we know from a lot of the literature is that guns are really rarely used to actually prevent someone from harming you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the numbers on that are incredibly sparse. So let me already just jump in on some of this stuff, unpack a couple things that you've already said. You said when 70 to 80 million people are doing something, does that mean out of our 340 million population, the 400 million guns are owned by 70 to 80 million people? That's right.
Yeah. Wow.
Everybody owns 5, 6, 8, 10 guns.
Well, when you hear the 400 million figure, it sounds like everybody owns a gun, but that's not true at all.
Right.
Actually, 60% of real American men do not own a gun.
Mm-hmm.
They're the gun collectors who have 20 guns or something like that.
Okay.
And that's how we account for the 400 million guns in America.
Okay. And that's one of the gun cultures, I suppose, is people who don't ever intend to actually use these things, or maybe they do in the, you know, in the backyard or something, but they're not thinking so much as of safety. They're more collectors. Of the people who say I have a gun or two guns or 10 guns because it will keep me safe, how true is that?
It's a very complicated question.
Just the look on your face is
So I think that, you know, I'm a psychologist.
Yeah.
And so when someone tells me they feel something, you know, it's not for me to tell them that they're wrong.
Right.
And so when someone says, well, a gun helps me to feel safe, okay, I believe you. I have no reason to doubt it. Whether a gun is actually keeping you safe, though, that's a very different question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that we look at is, you know, we think about gun violence in America. And most of the time when we're thinking that, you know, I think the average person will picture, you know, a mass shooting, you know, a school shooting, something that's big, traumatic, flashy. Those are overwhelmingly unlikely, just remarkably unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the number of people who die by gun violence in a given year, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction. Most gun deaths in the U.S. are deaths by suicide, about 60%. You look at the remaining gun homicides, almost all of those are, you know, one or maybe two deaths, oftentimes by somebody that you know. And so these sort of strangers rolling up, shooting people, leaving, that is not what gun violence looks like in America for the vast majority of these. It's very much small, intimate, maybe an argument that escalates, or more often than not, a death by suicide. And so when we think about, is a gun keeping you safe? You know, it's maybe helping you to feel safe, but if you have a gun in the house, I think it doubles the likelihood that someone in that house will die by a violent homicide, and at least triples the likelihood that someone in that house will die by violent suicide. Some of the numbers are even crazier. If you look in careful case-controlled studies from places like California, the estimate for some populations is a 24 times increase. So having a gun in your house does objectively seem to make it a much more dangerous place to be.
Which is so intuitive, because if you buy a car, you've just increased your likelihood of getting into an automobile accident, right? Yeah, yeah. It's harder to do that if you don't own a car. Yeah, that is amazing. What are the numbers in terms of when there is a homicide situation involving a gun? What are the numbers in terms of, does the gun belong to the perpetrator, or did the gun belong to the person who owned it for safety?
Well, I think some of both. But, you know, I want to get back to Nick's comments about buying guns for protection, making you feel safe.
Yes.
It didn't used to be that way. That's a phenomenon of the last 10 or 20 years. It used to be that people bought guns for hunting and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the thing that we have to realize is the massive effects of the gun lobby marketing this notion that guns will make you safer, when in fact they don't. Yeah. So the gun lobby is making money from this belief. Mm-hmm. And until we understand the massive psychological forces of the gun lobby, we're really not going to get this situation under control.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because the history of the NRA, when I was a kid, I thought of, and I've come from a non-gun owning household. My parents didn't own guns. I've never owned a gun. So I'm coming at this a little bit from the outside. But my recollection of the NRA when I was a kid was they would do hunting safety classes, and, you know, they would take your kid out and show you, you know, show the kid how to properly load the gun, how to carry the gun so that, you know, if it goes off, you're not going to harm somebody. And then at some point, I, as an adult, I realized that, wait a minute, they're now basically a lobbying organization. Can you run us through the history of
that?
How did the NRA go to that that dark corner?
Yeah. The NRA changed massively over the years. It was founded in 1871, right after the Civil War, to improve marksmanship. It turned out that men in the Civil War were terrible shots, so they thought they needed something to improve marksmanship. So it was this organization devoted to marksmanship, gun safety, hunting, and so on. 1977 was the crucial year, called the Revolt in Cincinnati.
Okay.
Two factions had emerged in the NRA at that point. One was the traditionalists, who wanted to continue with gun safety and hunting and so on. But there was a new wing, the Second Amendment hardliners, who wanted nothing to get between them and their guns. And the hardliners won. And ever since, the NRA has been an incredible lobbying organization, cowing state legislators into not passing gun safety laws, cowing the U.S. Congress into not passing things like an assault weapons ban. 90% of Americans favor an assault weapons ban, but we don't have one.
Right.
And it's because of that lobbying.
Wow. Is that lobbying, I imagine it takes many forms, but is it primarily in the form of campaign contributions? Hey, you know, we'll give you $5 million to get reelected, but you have to vote our way? Or are there other tools that the NRA is using as well?
Right. A little bit of it is campaign contributions. Some, they have a tremendous number of lobbyists who talk with legislators. I've been testifying in hearings, not in this state, in Missouri, where there's a gun lobby person sitting right at the end of the group hearing our testimony. So their presence is just overwhelming. And if you don't do what they want, they will put somebody up against you in the next election who will do their bidding.
What is their power level now and their influence level now, the NRA, as opposed to 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Is it increasing, decreasing? Do you see a trend?
They've had some scandals, and I know people who have quit the NRA. Their Wayne LaPierre resigned in disgrace, and they've had accounting problems and so on. So the NRA is maybe not quite as powerful, but there are other organizations like the Gun Owners of America, the GOA, which is even more radical in working for gun rights. And there are the sellers, the manufacturers and sellers, and they're part of this lobbying force too.
Right. And selling the idea that the, what is the phrase? The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And Nick, you've already shown us that that's a misnomer.
Yeah, I think if you look at what, say, police departments advise, let's say you're out in the world and you're carrying a gun concealed, like many people do, and you happen to be in these very rare settings where there's a mass shooting, you know, unbelievably rare, unbelievably unlikely.
Yeah.
What the recommendation is, almost uniformly from everything I've seen, from police departments, public safety, all that, is if you do have a gun on you and you're in a mass shooting, don't use it. Because it takes a tremendous amount of training to be able to be good in those situations, to have your sort of head up, to know who to shoot if you're trying to shoot somebody.
Right.
Those are, they're chaotic, they're foggy, and the likelihood that you will shoot the wrong person,
right,
that you'll accidentally harm a bystander, or if you're waving a gun around in the middle of a mass shooting situation and other people come on, you are likely to get shot in turn.
So
the recommendation is, don't do anything, because you're almost certainly going to make things worse and not better.
Yeah, that which makes so much sense. I mean, yeah, the number of decisions that need to be made very quickly in a situation like that require an immense amount of training. Nick, one thing I want to follow up with you on is, you said there is not one gun culture in America. There are many. Can you kind of run us through the category?
I think that, you know, when we think about what are the gun cultures of America, you know, it depends on what level of abstraction you'll be working on. You know, on the one hand, you can say, oh, you know, there's hunters. Okay, great. Right. But hunters are a really big category. You know, are you somebody who does deer? Do you do waterfowl? Do you do elk? Right. And then you can sort of break it down even farther. Do you have a certain sort of firearm that you like to use? You know, are you sort of working through that? But there's also, you know, within the gun cultures, a lot of them overlap in many ways. A person can be both somebody who enjoys hunting, someone who enjoys sport shooting, and also who has a gun in their nightstand to keep themselves safe. You know, I think when I talk to folks about the gun cultures that they see, you know, sometimes I'll get, you know, lists of 20 different gun cultures, and like the difference between them doesn't necessarily make sense to me.
Okay.
But I also see ones where, you know, people say, oh, there's two. So I think that, you know, part of this is a marketing question, right? You know, how are people segmenting, the various different sorts of things that they can sell? But a lot of it is, what is a gun doing for you, right? How do you imagine what this object is supposed to mean in your everyday life? You know, is it something that is helping you to have fun? Is it something that's helping you to sort of hang around other people? Is it just something that's there, like a tennis racket, you know, or is it fulfilling these more fundamental needs to help you feel safe, connected, like you're living a meaningful life? And I think it maybe makes more sense when we think about what gun cultures are, to think about what is the role both for the individual and in the social world that people are a part of. And so there won't be clean distinctions there. Everything is going to kind of blur.
Right. No, I realize that. Yeah, it's going to be there. There's going to be fuzzy edges.
Yeah. And I should say, on the point of hunters, hunters by and large are not the problem with gun violence in America.
I would think not.
They tend to be very safe. They have a culture of safety. One problem, though, is that they have guns accessible. So it's the suicide problem, but not the homicide problem so much. They tend to be very safe.
Yeah, I get the feeling from the hunting culture that they are interested in not only being safe, but being perceived as being very concerned with that, and that they educate people about that. And yeah, that does appear to be the case. What is it about, and I think that this is something that you both are very uniquely qualified to answer. We've identified some things about America that make us different from other countries in terms of the number of guns and the amount of gun violence. We've talked about the gun lobbies and the way that they get into people's heads. But are there other things about Americans that make us uniquely inclined toward buying multiple guns and actually using those guns and experiencing gun violence in all its many forms.
So I can say there's sort of two ways to think about that. Okay. You know, one very obvious reason is we have laws that let us. American gun laws are unusually lax, right? We have a Second Amendment, which has been interpreted as meaning that all Americans essentially have a right to a gun. Most places don't have that. And right. So we have a lot more guns because we have laws that let us have a lot more guns. Mm-hmm. And an industry that's sprung up over the past however many years, especially sort of moved into overdrive in the 60s and the 70s, to really sell guns to us. So there's a sort of supply component. But I think the demand part is also really interesting. You know, why is it that we want this? And a lot of the work that I've done sort of tries to figure out this question of where do these ideas come from in the first place? Why would we think that a gun helps to keep us safe? And, you know, one of the places that I try to drag this back to is the sense of safety. And in the work that I do, I sort of try to situate that sense of safety as coming from two places. One, a belief that the government is unwilling or unable to protect us. And two, a sense the world is dangerous. Right? Mm. If you have both of these, that should be really scary. You should be looking for an object that helps to fill that gap. Mm-hmm. And we've been told that guns do that. And one of the places where we see this idea that guns are the thing that protects us, that keeps us safe in a dangerous world, that sort of steps in and allows us to fulfill the roles of a government, mm-hmm. Is at the end of the Civil War. And so I'm gonna do a little bit of history.
Yeah, please. I'm all about the history. Yeah. That's where it all comes from.
The Civil War is an unbelievably destructive war.
Yeah. Right?
At the end of it, the South is in complete and total ruins.
Yeah.
It's also one of the very first wars that are fought with industrialized guns. So gunsmithing before the Civil War, largely artisanal, right? You have people sort of making guns one at a time, two at a time, three at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the years before the Civil War, they finally start to master the idea of industrial production. So you can have lots of guns that are much better, much more accurate.
Yeah, rifled barrels and all kinds of technological,
And so this means that everybody has a gun.
Yeah.
Everyone has a good gun. And, you know, when you look to the Civil War, to the South, at the end of the Civil War, you have a lot of people who are very well armed coming back into a society that is in complete tatters. Mm-hmm. There's a stat that I've seen quoted, which I still can't wrap my head around. If you go to Alabama in even the 1880s, so a few years after the war, you count up all of the farm machinery, all the industrial machinery that's existing. Mm-hmm. You count up the value of the guns. The guns are worth more.
Mm.
So imagine a society in which the guns that you have are the most valuable thing.
Right.
And so, as you might imagine, it's a really dangerous place to be. The homicide rate is estimated, 18, 20 times higher in the South than in the North during that period. And I did not know that. White people killing white people.
Yeah.
So you have, on the one hand, this society which is in ruins. And you also then have Reconstruction, this movement to elevate those who'd previously been enslaved, who have recently emancipated.
Yeah.
You have Black political power. And what we see is that the white planter elite, right, these folks who had been on top before the Civil War, try very, very hard to reclaim their privileges, mm-hmm. to sort of move back into a racial caste system. And part of that means they have to figure out how to repress this Black political power.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they do is start to connect white gun ownership with reclaiming Southern manhood. And this is a movement which we hadn't seen a whole lot of before the war, this idea that a gun can protect not just, you know, your farm from hogs or whatever, that your gun can also protect who you are from a government that's unable to protect you. And so you have this crystallization of the idea that a gun is a psychological tool, which seems at least partially rooted in this movement by a bunch of white supremacists to repress Black political power. And so we've been sort of tracing this idea through time. You know, one of the things that we find is that if you were in a Southern county that had either high rates of enslavement before the war, so where you had the sort of specter of Black political power, or even if you'd elected a Black legislator during Reconstruction, these are the places in the South that still today have the highest rates of gun ownership, and where gun ownership is most tightly tied to the idea of safety.
Okay.
And then as white Southerners left the Confederacy, a lot of them did, right? And they sort of moved into the rest of the country. We think that they brought these ideas with them. Mm. And so you can actually trace where do people move using census data. And those places where white Southerners moved after the war, these are the places in the North that have the highest rates of gun ownership. And even today have the most militant sorts of gun ownership, those folks who are the most interested in owning a gun because it's their political right. Mm-hmm. And so we think that, at least in part, this idea that a gun keeps you safe is formed in a movement at a specific time in a specific place and is carried throughout the rest of the country, priming the ground so that people are like, oh, I know this. This feels familiar. Okay. And so when all of a sudden the gun industry is like, hey, guns keep you safe, well, that sort of triggers a kind of cultural memory, which we are potentially especially likely to want to pick up.
Okay. Oh, that historical context is very clarifying. Thank you.
Well, and actually, I'd like to go back even a little farther in history.
Please,
Because everything Nick says is correct. But one of the questions is, why do we have a Second Amendment in our Constitution? Right. Other constitutions don't have it. It's not considered in other nations. It's not considered a fundamental right to have guns. Mm-hmm. And according to one historian, certainly there were things like Americans wanting to have guns in case King George came back, right?
Right.
That was part of it. But a lot of it had to do with representatives from the South who were Southern slave owners who had to have guns to keep down slave rebellions. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence in the negotiation over the Bill of Rights that they were going to refuse to approve the Constitution or the Bill of Rights unless it contained a right of all white men. To have guns. Yeah. So a lot of it originated even before the Civil War with passing the Second Amendment, which had a lot to do with white enslavers keeping down slave rebellions.
Okay. And I want to ask you about the Second Amendment because the first four words, right? You know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. A well-regulated militia. What happened to those four words? Those seem to have been ignored.
Well, people tend to forget that. If you ask them to quote the Second Amendment, they forget that.
Yes, they do.
It has to do with a series of Supreme Court decisions because up until 2008, I think it was, with the Bruin decision, it was the Supreme Court always held that the right to own guns was only in the context of a militia, mm-hmm. Only in the context of military service.
Right.
And then for the first time, there was this Bruin decision in 2008 that said that individuals have a right to guns. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had more than 200 years of American history that said, no, that wasn't it at all.
Right.
So things have gone downhill since that decision, although there are a few hopeful lights, like there was a ruling that a man who had committed domestic violence did not have a right to his guns.
Okay.
So that, you know, that's a good sign. But nonetheless, we are in a peculiar situation legally right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I would bet. And plus, you know, everybody recognizes that. What is a gun? Do we all have the right to go out and buy a grenade launcher, right? How do those lines get drawn?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the worries right now is 3D printing.
Yeah.
So that you can buy a pattern for a gun, print it at home, and there's no record of it. Mm-hmm. So that law enforcement can't possibly trace it. And that's a concerning thing. I mean, we're trying to outlaw that, but it's difficult.
Yeah. So in addition to the safety, there are also the corner of the of gun owners who seem to have a more proactive or sort of assertive approach of like, I'm doing this because I have the right. And what I'm referring to is we've all seen the pictures in social media of two guys or three guys in camo with a, you know, some kind of a semi-automatic, you know, clip to their belt, standing in line to buy a submarine sandwich or, you know, or in the fresh fruit aisle of the grocery store. What's going on there? Is that just I'm doing this because I can?
It's very complicated. My suspicion is that there's at least three things going on there.
Okay.
You know, one is they probably think it looks cool.
Okay.
And I don't think that you can sort of understate that. I think a lot of, you know, current day marketing around guns is very influencer driven. And that means looking cool, feeling like you're getting esteem from other people, that people think you look good or that you look important. Like that's really a big deal. And so the fact that they're wearing camo, right, they're sort of associating themselves with the military, a thing that they probably think is very interesting, very cool. Like that's a big part of it, right? You know, the gun looks military, they look military, therefore people they think will respect them.
Okay.
I think another part of it is that they may, at least some versions of this, think that what they're doing is their civic duty. That, you know, I don't know necessarily those guys who are like hanging out in the Starbucks line are exactly doing this, but there is some work that suggests that, you know, for a lot of people, they think of their carrying as a civic act. What they're doing is they're protecting their community, mostly the people they care about, against an uncaring, dangerous world. It comes back to this idea that one of the things that we've told ourselves is that if the world is dangerous, if the institutions of security aren't there to protect you, well, you've got to step up. Okay. And so what they may be doing is, oh, I'm protecting my people. You know, and are they? Excellent question.
Right.
They're probably also, you know, making the lives of people around them more dangerous.
Right.
But I think that there's a little bit of that. I think there also is this exclusionary bit, that what they're trying to do potentially as well is to intimidate their enemies.
Yeah.
Right. And so that there's this third piece where if guns have at least some root in an exclusionary sort of political order, one which is for certain people and explicitly against other people, what they might be doing is saying, you know, don't mess with me.
Right.
Here's me exerting my political power. And so I think open carry can sometimes do that, especially the sort of very blatant, explicit, you know, it's trying to control a political discourse.
Yes.
And I'm going to say that that's a very rare thing. Most people who open carry are doing something very different.
I realize that this isn't, this isn't happening. You know, we don't see this every day, but I'm just wondering about those more ostentatious displays. Before we wrap up, one of the things I was really excited about with talking to the two of you is that you both have an optimistic aspect to your research, that there is a problem, but there are also potential solutions. And I definitely want to be able to hit on that. So I'll start with you, Janet. What reasons do we have to be optimistic that this can get better and that we can start to address this?
Right. Well, I could give you a list of 20 things, but given the time, one of the things that's become really important is something called community violence interventions. Mm-hmm. And big cities across the country are starting to implement this. Baltimore was one of the earliest cities. Their program has been evaluated by Johns Hopkins and shown to be effective. Mm-hmm. It's a complex problem, but what you do in a big city is hire a bunch of staff who are called violence interrupters. They become friends with kids, adolescents, in neighborhoods that have high rates of gun violence. They learn to negotiate among those kids, get them to talk, to resolve a dispute rather than shoot each other. They provide all kinds of social services, like how you get a job, and some counseling. Some of these kids are terrifically traumatized, too.
I bet.
So these, and actually, the state of Wisconsin, with Tony Evers, established an office of gun violence prevention for the whole state. So people have access to that. And that's some of the best work we can do, is to work with individuals who are at risk of committing gun violence.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, you know, building on that, you know, when we think about where gun violence is, oftentimes it's in the home, and oftentimes it's something like a suicide.
Yeah. Right?
That guns are extremely effective at helping people to commit suicide. You know, most attempts that somebody tries with a gun, you know, succeed, for lack of a better word. Right. Whereas other forms of attempted suicide often don't. Right, it's usually about 50%. For guns, it's upwards of 90. And so when we think about how do we start to intervene on those sorts of deaths, you know, there's definitely things that research suggests can help. You know, the most effective is to make guns harder to get access to. Suicide is something that oftentimes will sort of have a wave type form. You sort of feel it sort of crests. And then if you don't act on it immediately, oftentimes that urge will ebb. So people who attempt suicide often don't attempt it again if they, you know, if they live. And so making a gun ever so slightly less accessible, so locking it up, leaving it unloaded, storing your ammunition separately.
Separately, right.
What that does is it makes it just that much harder to put all the pieces together, so that if you're in distress, if you're really, you know, sort of feeling this urge, you know, even a minute, 2 minutes, something as small as that can help you remember all the reasons why it's actually important to live.
Right.
And so, you know, helping people to understand where the dangers are, you know, or if you're in the middle of an argument, say, with somebody, you know, giving yourself that 20, 30, 40 seconds to sort of breathe, to maybe not escalate it, can be really important. And so if you have a gun that's incredibly accessible, you know, say that is unlocked, that's loaded, it becomes easier to act on these urges. And anything that helps us to sort of take those moments, reflect, seem to have real measurable consequences. So storage is one of the places where I know a lot of the work that I see out of public health is really focusing on, right? How do we make it so that people don't have this incredibly dangerous thing incredibly accessible for them to use or for someone to just come by, you know, potentially accidentally use?
Right.
So things that treat a gun with the sort of respect it's due as a dangerous object seem to be important.
And one of the important legal tools we have here are red flag laws or extreme risk protection order laws. Wisconsin does not have one. Wisconsin is kind of in the middle in terms of strength of gun regulations. But a red flag law allows law enforcement to temporarily remove firearms from a person who's deemed a danger to themselves, that's a suicide, or to others. And, you know, this is so obvious. Law enforcement ought to be able to do this, an important tool for them. So every state really needs to have a red flag law. And some people complain that it doesn't use due process, but it does, because you have to go to a judge to get the protection order.
Of course, yeah, that makes sense. Wow. Yeah, and of course, yeah, when we think about gun violence, we think of school shootings and we think of robberies and things like that. And I think that the suicide aspect is sometimes not given enough attention. So thank you both for bringing that up. Is there anything that either of you would like to say about the research or whatever that I just haven't asked the right question to get to and you'd like to make known?
I can give you a couple of Wisconsin numbers.
Please.
Every year in Wisconsin, 493 people die by suicide by gun. 493 people.
Yeah.
But it's often, you know, covered up. It's not reported. People are embarrassed about it. But those are deaths that are completely preventable.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Wow. Sobering. Nick, anything?
I think that, you know, it's just to reinforce, when we think about gun violence, we're often thinking about the things that are flashy, the things that, you know, get a lot of media attention, but that most aspects of gun violence are everyday. And so things that we do as everyday people, I think, have a really important role to play in bringing those numbers down, right? Nobody wants these numbers anywhere near as high as they are.
Right.
I think right now, guns are the leading cause of death for children under the age of 18.
Yeah, which is shocking to
more
me.
More than car
and at
crashes.
At one point, that was automobile accidents, yes, wasn't
right.
not? Yeah,
right.
And it got passed up. Wow.
And so, you know, having guns around makes it much more likely that a gun is going to be used.
Yeah.
And so, things that we can do to make guns less accessible can bring really, really, really high numbers down. I mean, the American rates of death by gun violence are so much higher than anywhere else in the world. You know, we're talking 10, 15, 20 times higher than anywhere else.
Yeah.
We have so many more gun deaths because we have so many more guns and because we have so many more guns that are accessible.
Yeah.
And so these are, I think, utterly preventable, totally needless deaths. And so things that we can do to make guns harder to use in the moment will help us quite a lot. You know, people are not using guns to ward off, you know, robbers. You know, that never happens, almost never, right? Those are things which we think about a lot because we see them, you know, in the media. Mm-hmm. You know, we, you know, see it, like, say, on Law & Order, if people are still watching that, you know, or any of the other spinoffs. But those are not common, anywhere near as common as somebody in your household using that gun to harm themselves. So realizing where the risks are can help us to sort of orient to what the key steps are to bring these numbers way down.
Yeah, people I've heard so often, especially in my line of work as an audio engineer, that people are like electrons. They take the path of least resistance. And if there's a gun right there, yeah, it's going to make a difference. The last thing I want to ask is just real quickly, this is all very heavy stuff. What do you both like to do for fun? Do you have hobbies or sports or anything that that you like to do in your spare time, Janet?
I love water aerobics.
Oh, terrific.
Fun. Yeah. And I'm a grandma, so I love going and watching my grandson's ultimate frisbee games.
Terrific.
And my granddaughter's soccer games.
Ah, terrific. Lovely. Nick?
Yeah. So since we're just coming out of the depths of winter, I'm a very mediocre curler. And so I'm trying to get better, but it is definitely a lovely thing to be able to do when it's very cold outside, to go to an even colder room and slide very heavy rocks down literal ice.
And it's non-violent.
I mean, it's kind of violent. Sometimes you're hitting stuff.
I suppose. But yeah, no, it's a fascinating sport to watch, because there's just so much the subtleties of, like, I want to make it move a little bit this way. And yeah, that's terrific.
I'm nowhere near good enough to master those subtleties. I'm going, like, if I can get within like 5 feet, I'm like, yeah, I did it.
There you go. Very, very cool. Well, you know what? When you do something for fun, you don't have to be great at it. You just have to enjoy it. Janet Shibley-Hyde, thank you so much. I really appreciate your work and research. And Dr. Nick Buttrick, it's been such a pleasure to have you both on. And I know a lot more now than I used to. And I would like to have another conversation at some point. But this has been very informative. Thank you both.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Assistant Professor Nick Buttrick and Professor Emerit Janet Shibley-Hyde. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studio in Madison, Wisconsin. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. Our engineer is Tori Niels. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.